House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 4th. We have an introduction. We have you. We do not. Okay. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill, 2327. Laura, please.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2327 comes to us at the request of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We're not looking at any amendments today. Oregon law presently contains a mechanism allowing Oregon State Bar to appoint counsel when an attorney becomes incapable of performing. House Bill 2327 clarifies and refines this process. It states that this process is to be used specifically for an attorney that has died, is disbarred, or suspended from the active practice of law, is incarcerated, or has abandoned the practice, and has either failed to make arrangements to appoint an individual that can adequately protect a client's interests. It also authorizes OSB to petition the court ex parte to take immediate control over an affected attorney's practice. It changes the notice and hearing process for that attorney. HB 2327 additionally requires any financial institutions holding funds in a lawyer trust account for the affected attorney to release those funds to OSB, who will then determine ownership and disperse them. HB 2327 also outlines OSB's requirements for retention of client materials and clarifies rules regarding representation, confidentiality, compensation, and expenses. The bill is ready to move.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Hirschheibel? I said that wrong, I'm sure, but okay.
Okay.
You know who you are.
Thank you.
And please remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Helen Hirschbiel, and I'm general counsel of the Oregon State Bar. And I understand, Chair Barker, that I'm being asked to speak a little bit about the Oregon State Bar generally first. Is that correct? Okay. So it is my pleasure to be here today, and thank you all for listening to me. The Oregon State Bar is a public corporation and instrumentality of the judicial branch of the state of Oregon. It's an integrated bar, which means that you have to be a member of the Oregon State Bar in order to practice law in Oregon. We have 15,000 active members, and our primary purpose and our primary function is a regulatory function. We provide protection to the public through those regulatory functions, promote competence of lawyers, and, of course, enforce the ethical standards for lawyers. So, for example, some of our regulatory functions include we're responsible for administering the admissions of Oregon lawyers. We're responsible for the Client Security Fund, which provides reimbursement to people who have been ripped off by lawyers. We also are responsible for enforcement of the unlawful practice of law statute. We have a fee arbitration program that provides a mechanism for lawyers and their clients to resolve disputes about fees. A big function of the Oregon State Bar is our disciplinary and regulatory services department. That department is responsible for prosecuting lawyers who have violated the rules of professional conduct. And then there is the Oregon State Bar also has a disciplinary board, from which trial panels are chosen who hear those disciplinary cases against lawyers. So those are just a few. There are others. Our mandatory continuing legal education department, things like that. Those are all our regulatory functions. We, of course, have other things that we do as well. We have a CLE, continuing legal education, and seminars and continuing legal education publications departments. We have a referral and information services department, and it's a huge benefit to the public. They call and we give them referrals to lawyers who may be able to assist them with their cases. Obviously, public affairs, I'm sure you're familiar with that department as well. And legal services. I don't want to miss legal services. That's another big part of what we do. We survive only on member fees and whatever revenue that we generate from our programs. We get no taxpayer dollars. There are filing fees that are paid to the Oregon State Bar Legal Services Program, but that program acts essentially as a pass-through for that money to go directly to legal aid. We're governed by a board of governors, and the board of governors consists of 18 people, 14 of whom are lawyers and 4 of whom are non-lawyers. There are some things that really make the Oregon State Bar unique. The first and foremost, unique and also we're very proud of this as well. First and foremost, we have an open disciplinary system. The Oregon State Bar is subject to the Public Records Act in Oregon, and as a result, all disciplinary cases from the very first moment that they are filed, a complaint is filed with our office, are open for people to review. We also, the Oregon State Bar is unique in that it requires mandatory malpractice insurance. All lawyers who have their principal place of business here in Oregon for the private practice of law are required to have malpractice insurance. And for that, we have a professional liability fund that provides that coverage. We also are unique in the sense that we have a lot of public involvement in what we do. I mentioned before that we have 4 public members who serve on our governing body. In addition to that, we have public members who serve in various roles throughout the disciplinary process. So the very first piece of the disciplinary process is making a charging decision. In other words, deciding whether or not to bring a complaint against a lawyer for violating the rules of professional conduct. And the body that makes that decision is the State Professional Responsibility Board. And that board has public members on it. The disciplinary board that I mentioned before that's responsible for hearing the disciplinary cases, it also has public members on it. In fact, every trial panel includes 2 lawyers and 1 non-lawyer public member. So we have, in various other committees for the bar, there's public member involvement throughout the bar's activities. We also have, and this is true for the lawyers in Oregon, not so much the Oregon State Bar, but the lawyers in Oregon really stand out as committed to pro bono service and to contributing to the access to justice through contributions to the Campaign for Legal, the Campaign for Equal Justice, which is a nonprofit organization that is specifically charged with fundraising for legal aid, and that's unique to Oregon as well. So that's just a little bit about the Oregon State Bar, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions about House Bill 2327. Is this an okay time, or would you want to?
You know, I have some prepared remarks, although I love what Ms. Hansel said in summary about House Bill 2327, but I did have, I was going to mention some things about that as well.
Thank you.
Do you want me to go ahead with House Bill 2327? Okay. So House Bill 2327, as Ms. Hansel mentioned, relates to the custodianship statute, which provides for lawyers. Let me see if I can find this. Try not to edit. Okay, so it provides for lawyers to, it provides for the Oregon State Bar to initiate a proceeding to take control and responsibility for a lawyer's practice when the lawyer is no longer able to take care of the practice. And there are 4 major changes that we are asking to be made to the custodianship statute with House Bill 2327. The first of which is to clarify when the Oregon State Bar should take custodianship. And rather than have and it does this in 2 ways. The first of which is it eliminates the sort of vague and general language of without good reason has ceased to devote or is incapable of devoting time to the practice, and instead enumerates the situations where that is going to occur when a lawyer is disbarred or suspended or incarcerated or has abandoned the practice or has died. In the past, it's not been entirely clear that the statute applied in a situation where a lawyer had died. So that's the first way in which we're trying to clarify when the Oregon State Bar would get involved in a custodianship proceeding. The second way is by limiting the bar's involvement only to those situations where the lawyer has not taken some steps to arrange for the orderly windup of the lawyer's practice, or where the lawyer might have taken steps, but for whatever reason, it's inadequate. So a personal representative is trying to wind up the practice upon a lawyer's death, but for some reason, it's not working, and so they need the Oregon State Bar's help. So those are the two ways that we're trying to clarify with this bill when the bar should get involved in initiating a custodianship proceeding. The second major change that House Bill 2327 seeks to the custodianship statute is to the notice provisions. And in the current statute as it reads, prior to even filing a custodianship petition, the bar has to send a letter certified by certified mail and get to the lawyer and give the lawyer 7 days to respond. What we found, the difficulty or the limitation, I think, with that particular provision became very apparent in a case that you may all have read about in the papers regarding a lawyer in Bend who had abandoned his practice. He was not responding to the bar. He was not responding to clients. There were numerous complaints that were pending in our office about the lawyer not returning client funds or funds to third parties. And the bar decided to initiate a custodianship proceeding in that case. Because of the notice requirements, it was 25 days from the time that the bar sent the letter to the lawyer until there was an order appointing the bar custodian and we could actually take control of his practice. Now, 25 days might not seem like that great a time, but when you're talking about a situation where a lawyer, in this case, was stealing and stole over $1 million from various individuals, time is money, so to speak, and it becomes very important to be able to act quickly to protect clients. So that's the reason for that notice provision. For those people who are concerned about due process for the lawyer, I have a couple of responses to that. The first is, I think, the limitations that are included in that first set of changes that I mentioned should provide some relief to concerns that the bar might get involved when they shouldn't be getting involved. Secondly, the lawyer will still be served with the order and be given an opportunity to ask for a hearing and to have that order set aside. It just pushes the notice to after the order appointing a custodian. It's sort of similar to what happens in a FAPA or a Family Abuse Protection Act proceeding. For those of you who may be more familiar with that kind of situation, you get an immediate order for relief because there's an emergency situation, because there's the possibility of imminent harm, and then allow for the hearing after that is in place. The third change, and it's really three and four are sort of similar, have to do with the disposition of the client property and client funds and client files. With respect to client funds, the changes make clear that the Oregon State Bar has the authority to take control of the trust account, and then also makes clear the Oregon State Bar's responsibility with respect to those funds once we have that control. With respect to the client files, again, it makes clear the Oregon State Bar's authority to take over those files, and secondly, their responsibility with respect to those files. And the one big piece there is the wills. We had a situation that where actually it's still ongoing. The personal representative is still trying to figure out what to do with these wills. A lawyer had died. It was a solo practitioner. And as was the common practice for many years, the lawyer had kept original wills that he had drafted for his clients. And when he died, he had over 100 wills in his possession. And through the probate process and with the help of the professional liability fund, some of those wills we were able to return to the original clients, but there were a number of wills where we were not able to do that because we didn't know where the clients were. So there are provisions in ORS Chapter 112 for disposing of wills in that situation, either filing with the court or in some cases you can actually destroy the wills. But it costs a lot of money to do that, and frankly, the estate had no money to do that. It would have been thousands of dollars for over 50 wills to do that. And so that's the reason for the changes to the custodianship statute with respect to the wills. I think that covers it. The other thing I guess I wanted to mention is the one piece that was retained and that we think is very important to retain in the custodianship statute is the oversight of the court. The court will continue to have oversight over the bar's activities as custodian for a lawyer's practice, and the bar will have to account to the court for what it has done in the custodianship.
Any questions? Thank you very much, especially for your overview of the bar.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming. It's nice to see you again at the beginning of the session, and I always appreciate how detailed your testimony is. So my question, and I just, some deja vu, I guess Groundhog's Day was this week. Didn't we kind of do this bill before? Because I seem to recall carrying it on the floor. In fact, I carried it in two versions. Number one, I remember, because after Brian Grutter incident in Deschutes County, we realized we need to change some things. So I recall carrying a bill involving the Client Security Fund. And I also seem to recall carrying a bill, unless I'm just, it'd be a weird thing for me to make up. relating to the first two portions, essentially when the bar can take control and the limitations, and also perhaps even the notice provisions. I don't recall dealing with the custodianship portion of it, but didn't we do some stuff on this, and somehow is it not adequate? Has something happened? Can you fill me in, please?
Sure. Chair Barker and Representative Barton, you're not making it up. We did make some changes to the custodianship statute. the last full session in 2013. But those changes, as I recall, were not to the notice provisions,
okay. But
were only to the payment, getting reimbursement for costs. There was a limit there in that case, that Grutter case. There was a creditor that managed to get was ahead of us, mm-hmm. and really shouldn't have been ahead of us,
yeah.
And so we made changes to the priority of payment for costs and expenses out of the custodianship.
Okay.
But as I recall, there were not any other changes.
Thank you for that. That helps.
Yes. Representative Greenleck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two, I think, simple questions. I noticed in the causes where the bar can take over the practice, disability is not one of them. Does disability fit into this in some way? I mean, the lawyer has a stroke, he's a private, a solo practitioner. Would this cover that circumstance?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenleck, that is a very good question. It could be covered as an abandonment of the practice, but frankly, we didn't feel that it was necessary to specifically include that because we actually have in our bar rules of procedure a mechanism for basically involuntarily making an attorney inactive when they're on disability status, and a mechanism for winding down their practice in those rules.
That would trigger if you made him inactive, that would trigger your conservatorship or whatever this is in the same process.
That's right. That's exactly right.
May I ask another question?
Yes, you sure can.
I noticed a lot of stuff that's in italics here, so it's eliminated. And I was wondering, what problem are you really trying to solve here? How does the process work? How does it work right now compared to how it will work here? I mean, I assume you didn't have the ability to go in and establish conservatorship or something.
For clarification, how would the process work in a disability situation or another situation?
I'm thinking now you have a bill that has, in our practice, bold things that you've added and italicized things that have been deleted. You deleted a whole bunch of stuff, which I assume defined how it works today before this bill is passed. I was wondering, what's the problem with how it's working today that causes you to move forward with this proposal?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlich, I guess the biggest way that the process will change is that under the current version, before the bar can file a petition for custodianship, the bar has to send the lawyer a letter saying, we're planning to file a petition for custodianship. They have to send it certified mail. Once the lawyer gets it, assuming the lawyer gets it, it's not really clear what happens once the lawyer gets it, the bar has to wait 7 days. After that 7 days expires, then the bar can file a petition for custodianship. When the bar files that petition, they have to serve the lawyer with a copy of the petition. They have to make sure the lawyer gets a copy of the petition. And it's not clear, actually, under the current version of the statute, whether the bar has to wait 30 days and give the lawyer an opportunity to answer or not. That's not the way that we have done it before. We've asked the court to set an order to show cause hearing. So the lawyer then appears at that hearing, and the court decides at that hearing whether to appoint a custodian or not. So that time frame, and the Grutter case was one example, for that to happen, the time between when the bar first starts to when they get the order for custodianship, is about 30 days. The way the process would work under House Bill 2327 is the bar would not provide any advance notice. The bar would simply file a petition for custodianship and do it ex parte, ask for an immediate order appointing a custodian. Presumably the court would, if we had established the elements required for the court to take jurisdiction, the court would do that and would issue an order. And that we would serve that, and so that could happen within a day or two. We could have an order appointing us custodian. That order we would then serve on the lawyer, and the lawyer could ask for a hearing. And that hearing would have to be set, I think it's within 10 days, I think is what the House Bill 2327 says. And at the hearing, the lawyer could say, look, I'm capable of taking care of my practice. I'm fine. I want to continue. I'm not dead. You thought I was dead, but I'm not. Right. Right. So does that explain it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Representative Polsky.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm really more of a comment. I just to go back to the beginning, really nothing to do with this bill. I just want to say thanks for your opening explanation of the Oregon State Bar and all that, because this is new to me. And that was very simply and well put, and I could understand it, and I really appreciated that. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2327. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move. Oh, you can use the No, okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2327 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2327 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Barr, do you want to carry it again?
I'd be pleased to, Mr. Chair.
You got it right this time, please.
The evolution of this
issue. No. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2328.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2328 also comes to us from the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill and no amendments today. So current Oregon law states that any action, suit, or proceeding may be prosecuted or defended by a party in person or by attorney, except that the state or a corporation must appear by attorney in all cases. Corporation, however, is left undefined and is not only in this statute section, but several others. And so that has led to some ambiguity. Some individuals have applied a very narrow definition to that and have thought that they do not need to appear formally by attorney. Several state court opinions, however, find a much broader meaning of the term corporation, ruling that the requirement also applies to LLCs, partnerships, trusts, unincorporated associations, and other entities. House Bill 2328 clarifies the statute and its meaning by deleting the word corporation and instead inserting party that is not a natural person, both in ORS 9.320 and other relevant sections. This bill is ready to move.
Thank you.
You identify yourself once again.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Helen Hirschfield. I'm general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2328. We really see this as simply a housekeeping bill in a lot of respects. As stated by Ms. Hansel, the statute ORS 9.320 requires that allows individuals to appear in court with an attorney, but requires that the state and corporations appear through an attorney. And the Oregon Supreme Court and Court of Appeals have determined that that really requires any entity to appear before a court with an attorney, as opposed to through some other authorized representative of the entity. And we're concerned that people may be, especially members of the public, may read this very narrowly and either feel that they can appear on behalf of their LLC, for example, on their own, or that it's okay for the LLC who's opposing them to be appearing through a member of the LLC, for example. So this is just, again, like I say, I think it's more of a housekeeping matter, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you all may have about it.
Okay. Are there any questions, Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to make sure I understand this correctly, this bill is not actually changing existing law. We are simply clarifying the statute so that members of the public who might not be familiar with the existing case law, such that it will be clear in statute. Did I get that right?
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, you said it much better than I did. Yes, that's exactly it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2328.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Greenlick, would you carry that for us, please?
I would be absolutely delighted to.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2333.
Yes, thank you, Chair Parker, members of the committee.
I'm ready.
House Bill 2333 comes to us from the Oregon State Bar's Family Law Section. It has no revenue impact. I am going to check and see if we have paperwork back on the other. So no amendments today. In 2007, the Oregon legislature had passed House Bill 2366, which amended Oregon's minority tolling statute. The goal of that statute or of that bill was to extend the statute of limitations for actions brought by parents in an effort to reach consistency with statute of limitations applicable to children's claims arising from the same incidents. However, there was some unintended consequence it would seem, during drafting, specifically rewarding an action mentioned in to an action that is subject to the relevant ORS sections had rendered the statute inapplicable to claims brought under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. This has happened in a couple of cases at least. So House Bill 2333 aims to correct this unintended consequence by clarifying language to state applicability to actions mentioned in the relevant ORS sections. Additionally, House Bill 2333 asserts that if it causes the revival of a claim formerly barred under ORS 12.160, which addresses suspension for minors and persons who are insane, immediately before its effective date, then that cause of action must be commenced within the time prescribed as amended by this bill. It is not ready to move, we don't think.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Olson, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, representatives. My name is Erin Olson. I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm here on behalf of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. It actually wasn't the Family Law Committee, but the Procedure and Practice Committee. That's the committee that brought you the amendment that we're here to fix back in 2007. And that's the committee I approached when I realized that this was an issue. The problem is real. There are two cases before the Oregon Court of Appeals right now involving claims of children that have been dismissed on account of the unintended consequence that's now in ORS 12-160. So the effect of this bill, if passed as it presently reads, would be to moot those issues at the Court of Appeals and return things to the way they were in 2007, and I believe the way they were intended. The language was taken from the prior bill, and it's language that's been interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court and the Oregon Court of Appeals, so we're pretty confident with how they would interpret the language that we're seeking to put back in. This was an unintended consequence, and we just ask that you correct it.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Since it's not ready to go, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2333.
You're weird, is right.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2335. Eric, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2335 has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and there are no amendments before the committee. The bill amends ORS 164.205 of the Criminal Code, and it changes the definition of enter or remain unlawfully. Specifically, it modifies the definition to become similar with a Supreme Court case from 1981 where the Oregon Supreme Court interpreted the or in sub 3A as an and. This bill would codify that case law.
Jamie Contreras, please. Please go ahead and remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Contreras, and I'm here today to represent the Uniform Criminal Jury Instructions Committee of the State Bar. This is probably the simplest amendment you're going to see all day. It literally changes a single word of the definition of enter or remain unlawfully. As it stands right now, the statute reads in a way that there are two requirements, and they're listed as alternatives. But really, you need both of them to have a crime, and that's to enter or remain in or upon premises when the premises at the time of such entry or remaining are not open to the public, or when the entrant is not otherwise privileged or licensed to do so. So if premises are open to the public, then there's not a crime to be there. And if you're licensed to be there, but it's not open to the public, that's not a crime either. You need both to be true. And that's what State versus Hartfield held We've had some Court of Appeals cases, a recent one, where we were just looking at the case law and thinking, how are we going to fix this jury instruction to explain why we're interpreting or as and? And we thought it would just be a lot simpler to get the statute fixed. So I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Can you give me an example of the situation of that, please?
Excuse me?
Can you give me an example of the situation that we're talking about? Somebody goes in a store.
Well, you have someone in a store at the time that the store is closed, right? They're not, and they don't have authority to be there. They don't work there. It's not open to the public, and it's, or when it's, someone's not entitled to be. It could even be a house. I mean, it doesn't have to be a business. Maybe I'm not.
I'm thinking, okay, so you're talking about a store, a grocery store, and it closes at 10, but we have somebody that decides that he's going to stay there well after 10.
Right.
Okay. I mean, you're not going to have burglary from that.
No, it'd probably be criminal trespass, and that this definition applies to both burglary and criminal trespass, multiple degrees of those crimes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How could we have missed this for 34 years?
That's a good question. It pops up every once in a while, and I think everybody just kind of understood Hartfield. Everybody read Hartfield, I guess. Huh. But occasionally people don't read Hartfield, and they're tripped up by the statutory language, quite understandably. Statute says what it says.
Any questions?
Yeah, I'm having a little trouble getting my head around this very complicated change. I'm trying to imagine the circumstance where or would cause a problem. I mean, somebody comes in inappropriately, but they are licensed to be there. Would that be a circumstance?
Well, they wouldn't be coming in inappropriately if they're licensed to be there. And that's a way that you can be on premises lawfully. If you have the license, even if the store is closed, but if the manager tells you that you're entitled to be there after hours, then you're there lawfully. It's just a way to define being on premises unlawfully. I'm sorry.
So an example of somebody who was prosecuted under the or idea, that's what I'm looking for. It seems to me it's automatically both. So I'm wondering what.
It is automatically both, and it should be to be guilty of a crime to actually. But that's the issue with Hartfield is it says or in the statute, but it really means and, that you have to have both of these things true to be guilty of the crimes at issue. Does that make sense?
One more try. Sure. There were instances when somebody was tried, yes, when they were only conditional on one or the other, but not on both. Is that the problem?
I don't know if anyone was tried that way. The issue is at least from our perspective in the jury instructions committee, is that you have a jury if the jury is instructed on the language of the statute, it's misleading. So I don't know if anyone has been prosecuted improperly. There's just it's a potential for jury confusion.
Causes some confusion as part of the instruction.
Right.
I got you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. House Bill 2333 is not ready yet.
It's ready.
Right,
it's
okay.
Ready.
Open a work session on House Bill 2335.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2335 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2335 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Oh, I would be delighted to.
Representative Olson will be the carrier.
Representative Post looked excited.
Oh,
there.
Okay. Yeah, well, Representative Post can carry.
And Orville.
All right.
Wouldn't this be illogical for the consent calendar?
In criminal law.
I think you have to kind of explain this one.
Yeah.
Well, better than it's been explained so far, I would hope.
Mr. Chair, before because it looks like this is making something a crime, he would have objected if we put this on the consent calendar before he was on the committee.
Yeah,
he would have been exactly the person who would have objected.
Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2336.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2336 also comes from the Oregon State Bar. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. It's not ready to move at this time. The bill modifies ORS 19.260 and expands the methods in which a person can file a notice and serve an appeal with the appellate courts. Specifically, the bill as drafted would expand the methods from the current methods of service and through the mail to commercial carriers, including UPS, FedEx, and the like.
Okay. Jordan Silk and Bruce Miller.
Why don't we do it by computer?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Jordan Silk. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt in Portland, where I devote a significant amount of my practice to appellate litigation. Today I'm here on behalf of the appellate practice section of the Oregon State Bar to testify in support of HB 2336. As Mr. Dietrich mentioned, HB 2336 amends 19260 in order to bring third-party commercial carriers such as UPS and FedEx into the mix in terms of methods that you can use for filing and service a notice of appeal. That statute right now has a rule that allows you to use the date of mailing as the official filing date, but you can only qualify for that rule if you use the United States Postal Service. This statute amends 19260 to allow the use of that rule when the filer uses a third-party carrier such as UPS and FedEx, and that would be consistent with how other appellate documents are filed, because the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure allow third-party carriers with respect to other documents. This issue is an important one because in Oregon, the failure to timely file and serve a notice of appeal is considered a jurisdictional defect in the appeal. And so what that means is if you don't file and serve a notice of appeal within 30 days of the judgment that you're appealing from, the Oregon Court of Appeals actually loses all power to consider your appeal. And unlike the federal courts, it has no discretion to forgive an untimely notice of appeal, regardless of the circumstances surrounding why it was filed late. The ultimate result being that the litigant's right to prosecute an appeal in the Oregon appellate courts is lost forever. In light of that, and given the regularity with which third-party commercial carriers are used by practitioners, both in the appellate courts for other appellate documents and throughout all sorts of different practices. This distinction can be a pretty tricky malpractice trap for practitioners who are not working with appeals on a regular basis and don't realize that notices of appeal need to be treated differently than other documents that they might be filing in the ordinary course of their business. So in sum, the appellate practice section of the Oregon State Bar supports this bill because it would avoid significant prejudice to litigants that results from a technical defect in the filing method sometimes, and it would also avoid a malpractice trap for lawyers. Thanks for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Go ahead, Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the state court administrator. The Oregon Judicial Department doesn't have any problem with the notion behind this bill. We are concerned about an ambiguity or two that we see in here. In particular, we're concerned about the phrase mailed for delivery within 3 calendar days. We think that may need some additional definition. Does it mean that the carrier is guaranteeing 3-day delivery? Does it mean the sender is guaranteeing 3-day delivery? Is it an unspecified expectation of delivery? If I'm in Portland and mail first class down here, I expect it to be here in 3 days or less, but it becomes problematic. And I think where the appellate section is going is they're talking about a class of delivery, and I think that we're happy to if the committee's willing and the bar's willing, we're happy to work with them to clean that up. Jim Nass, our appellate commissioner, has been in contact with the appellate section over the last few days, and we're working our way down that road to try to remove that ambiguity so that the bill does what it's supposed to do, which is not be correct any traps for the unwary. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions on that? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Can I ask a question? Straight out.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Dominating today. So, such interesting bills. As we move more and more to e-court, why can't we do this electronically?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we are moving that way, especially in the appellate courts. We're just about ready to make it mandatory for everyone. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. But even then, you will have a class of parties who may not be subject to it, especially self-represented parties. There are certain instances where you have to allow people to be able to file a traditional paper petition.
Well, why don't we make, at this time that we're changing this, why don't we allow electronic filing as a way inside the three-day standard? I mean, this would be a good time to do it. It wouldn't make it mandatory, but it would make it one method you could use.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, that's already part of the appellate system, so parties can file their notice of appeal electronically, but they may not choose to at this point. At some at some near point in time, they will have to, but we're not quite there yet.
And the time stamp works on an electronic submission, is that right?
Mr. Chair,
to deal with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, it does. When it comes into our system, it's down to the second, I believe, but at least to the minute. So, if you have to file, your deadline is 12:59 p.m., that will appear when you file it. We'll know what time. If it comes in at 1:01 a.m., then it will be obvious that you're too late.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 2336 and get that worked out to come back to move it. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Once again, we'll turn over.